Welcome. We're going to get started. I'm Allison Ho. I serve on the executive committee of the litigation group of the Federalist Society, and it is my great pleasure to welcome you to today's panel discussion on federal consent decrees. First, a couple of housekeeping items. For those of you who are seeking CLE credit, you are required to sign in each day to receive credit. And if you haven't already done so, please use the QR code. I have no idea what that is. Hopefully you do. On the CLE card that's provided. If you don't have that card, there are volunteers in the room with extra cards who would be happy to provide them to you. And the code is also posted outside the room on an easel. And just please be advised, some states require you to sign out as well. Second, I've been asked to announce that per DC regulations, please wear a mask unless eating or drinking. So I suspect I will be putting on more weight during the annual convention than I normally do, given that rule. And now I have the great pleasure of introducing our moderator, Judge Lisa Branch of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit. This is a point of real personal privilege for me. I first met Judge Branch 20 years ago in 2001 when both of us attended our very first Federalist Society National Lawyers Convention, the first of many. From private practice as a commercial litigator in Georgia to high-level stints at the Department of Homeland Security, the Office of Management and Budget, to the Georgia Court of Appeals, and now to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit, Judge Branch truly exemplifies the ideals of the society, and it's my great honor to introduce her as our moderator today. Judge Branch.
I have to say it's also a point of privilege to have Allison do that introduction. That was a surprise to me, and Allison is, as she indicated, she is a dear friend of mine. We go so far back when I was up here serving in the Bush administration, both Allison and her husband, Jim, who's also now a federal judge. So this kind of makes my day, my week, my month to have you a part of this, so thank you. I'm always honored to serve as moderator for a panel at the Federal Society's annual Lawyers Convention, and I'm particularly honored to do so this year as we work toward returning to normal, being back in person. I know that that is a point of privilege and pleasure for all of us to be back resuming everything as normal as much as possible. And it's also particularly meaningful for me to serve on this panel today on Veterans Day, when we can honor all those who served our country. Welcome to the lunch panel for the first day of the conference. The only concern I had about this lunch panel, and I did express to Dean, is he pitted all the 11th Circuit judges up against each other. We're all moderating lunch panels today, and he seemed puzzled when I pointed that out. I don't think he had noticed that. So I cannot do my normal support of my colleagues by attending their panels. So, but this our panel today, I'm very pleased to be serving on this, titled Federal Consent Decrees, Good Governance, an expansion of federal power, or both. Consent decrees are used by the federal government to settle lawsuits in various contexts, those brought by the federal government and those brought against the federal government. They are entered as judgments enforceable by contempt without full litigation, and they've been so used for decades. Not surprisingly, different presidential administrations have taken different approaches to consent decrees to address the concerns they raise and the benefits they provide. In 1986, in fact, during the Reagan administration, Attorney General Meese instructed Department of Justice lawyers not to enter into consent decrees that significantly constrain the discretion of executive agencies. And jumping to a more modern time, the more current tension between administrations is shown shown by the fact that in 2018, in the Trump administration, Attorney General Sessions implemented policies on consent decrees with state and local entities that were designed to reduce the circumstances when they would be used, and to limit the scope when they were negotiated. He said the DOJ, quote, must ensure that its practices in such cases are in the interests of justice, transparent, and consistent with the impartial rule of law and fundamental constitutional principles, including federalism and democratic control and accountability. More recently, in 2021, in fact, in August, in the Biden administration, Attorney General Garland rescinded the Sessions memo and said the Department of Justice would, return to the traditional process that allows the heads of litigating components to approve most settlement agreements, consent decrees, and the use of monitors in cases involving state and local entities. Our distinguished panel today will address those issues during its discussion. I will briefly introduce our four panelists in the order in which they will speak. Please note these are very brief introductions and that you will find their more detailed biographies on the Federalist Society website. Each panelist will then deliver brief remarks. I will ask a few questions of the panel before we turn to the audience for questions. Jesse Panuccio, a dear friend of mine, is going to be our first speaker. He is a partner at Boies Schiller, and he has offices in D.C. and Florida. Before he joined the firm, Jesse was the acting associate attorney general at the Department of Justice, the third ranking official. He served for 3 years as the secretary of the Florida Department of Economic Opportunity, and before that, he served as governor, now Senator Rick Scott's general counsel. He's going to discuss how consent decrees are a form of legislation outside of the democratic process or serious judicial testing, which raise separation of powers, federalism, and good government issues. Next up will be Ben Wolf. Ben was the legal director of the ACLU of Illinois from 2015 to 2020. Before he took that position, he was the director of the ACLU of Illinois' Institutional Reform Project since 1984. Before he joined the ACLU legal staff, he was an associate at Jenner and Block in Chicago. Ben's going to share his positive experiences with consent decrees, which he considers to be an important tool for addressing serious problems he has encountered in his years as a civil rights lawyer representing vulnerable people. Andrew McCarthy is a contributing editor at National Review, a senior fellow at National Review Institute, and a Fox News contributor. He is also a best-selling author. He is a former chief assistant U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York, who notably led the terrorism prosecution against the blind sheikh after the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. He will argue that consent decrees are non-democratic vehicles that undermine federalism principles when the federal government seeks to implement transformational change as to state and local government entities. And last but certainly not least, Robert Percival is the Robert Stanton Professor of Law and Director of the Environmental Law Program at the University of Maryland School of Law. Before he joined the faculty, he was a senior attorney for the Environmental Defense Fund. He wrote one of the first articles on the propriety of consent decrees to effectuate and enforce federal law in 1987. He will discuss how consent decrees have proven to be a useful and efficient means for ratifying and enforcing settlement agreements entered between plaintiffs and government entities. I will now turn the microphone over to Jesse.
Well, thank you, Judge Branch, for that kind introduction. It is great to be with you and this distinguished panel and this crowd back in person in the Mayflower. So thanks. I'm really happy to be here. So our topic this morning is, as you've heard, the modern-day use of federal consent decrees. But I'd like to start briefly with first principles, which I think should help orient our thinking on this issue. Madison famously lamented in Federalist 51 that men are not angels, and thus they need a government. He explained, in framing a government which is to be administered by men over men, the great difficulty lies in this. You must first enable the government to control the governed, and in the next place, you must oblige it to control itself. Now, the framers accomplished this through the structural constitution. That is how the government was to control itself. But the administrative state has long since eviscerated most of those controls, and federal agencies, especially the Department of Justice, often wield the very unchecked and uncontrolled power the framers knew was destructive of liberty. Consent decrees are a powerful, but I think underappreciated and underanalyzed example of this phenomenon. A consent decree, as Judge Branch mentioned, is a settlement by parties reduced to a binding court judgment, meaning that unlike a violation of an out-of-court settlement, which can lead to a breach of contract claim, a violation of a consent decree can lead to contempt, including criminal contempt. In other words, consent decrees have the force and effect of law and are very serious business. Consent decrees can and do serve an important function in a range of cases and enforcement areas. But many consent decrees are, in effect, a set of regulations for a single party or government agency overseen by the Department of Justice, a federal judge, and quite often a private party monitor appointed by the court. In practice, consent decrees can result in one or all of these entities directing the day-to-day operations of a business or local government agency for years on end. As should be obvious from the description, such a regime can be as intrusive as, if not more intrusive than, a set of regulations. Take, for example, the consent decree that now governs the City of Chicago Police Department, a decree that DOJ objected to in 2018 under Attorney General Sessions, but one that is similar in substance to many that DOJ required in years past and will surely require again during the Biden administration. Regarding the Chicago decree, DOJ noted this. The decree is a 226-page document governing virtually every facet of Chicago Police Department operations in excruciating detail. The decree's 799 paragraphs and hundreds more subparagraphs cover community policing, impartial policing, crisis intervention, use of force, recruitment, hiring, promotion, training, supervision, officer wellness and support, accountability, transparency, and data collection. Indeed, if you were to go to the Chicago Police Department website right now, you could find on their page what they call a compliance consent decree dashboard. It has 797 requirements governing nearly every aspect of the department's operations. The consent decree is, in effect, the city agency's governing charter at this point. There are many potential problems with such wide-ranging consent decrees, and I'll highlight just some of them. First, consent decrees turn DOJ litigators, private plaintiffs, federal judges, and private monitors into regulators, even if they lack the time or expertise to properly regulate. 30 years ago, the then Assistant Attorney General for the Antitrust Division, Rick Rule, noted in a speech that the Reagan administration's best-known accomplishment in antitrust law was the breakup of AT&T. The ongoing monitoring required under the AT&T consent decree, however, created, in his words, a mixed legacy for that accomplishment because of the institutional harms flowing from requiring the division and a federal court to be, in effect, telecom regulators. Federal courts and the Antitrust Division, Rule said, inherently lack many of the resources crucial to successful regulation, such as technical expertise, regulatory experience, and administrative processes. So that's one problem. A second problem with consent decrees, and perhaps the most egregious, is that many of them stray not only beyond the practical resources and expertise of the enforcers, but also beyond the legal authority of what the government could do by any other means. Imposing conditions that could not be obtained through litigation to judgment is similar to creating regulations beyond the bounds authorized by statute. It creates serious due process and separation of powers questions. And just because a court imposes such a decree does not make it appropriate, legal, or wise. Courts, like executive branch agencies, I'm sorry, Judge, can exceed their powers and distort constitutional norms in certain circumstances. A third issue for consent decrees is that they often empower private party monitors as independent agents of the court. Courts regularly defer to monitors as the decrees are complex and voluminous. Without a monitor's assent, it is very rare, exceedingly rare, that a federal judge will terminate a decree, even I've seen in circumstances where both the government and the defendant agree that the decree should be terminated. The problem is that monitors are not government officials clothed with official power. They are not elected and they are not appointed. They are not accountable once appointed to the DOJ or to the defendants, and they are paid often very handsomely for their work. For example, let's look again at the Chicago consent decree. Here's what DOJ said about it in its objection at the time. The monitor costs alone will be staggering. The monitor can be paid $2.85 million per year, more than 10 times both the police superintendent's salary and the mayor's salary, and 59 times the starting salary for a beginning Chicago Police Department officer. These taxpayer funds thus will not be available to hire and train more officers and purchase equipment to protect Chicago residents. Now, many monitors are honest brokers and do good work, but that doesn't change the fact that they wield tremendous, unaccountable power over the local governments and businesses they monitor. They are very costly, and for better or worse, they face obvious financial incentives to keep the monitorship going, especially when the fees represent a substantial income stream for their law firms or their consultancies. A fourth problem with consent decrees is that in practice, consent decrees have virtually perpetual life, regardless of factual changes, scientific advancements, elections, economic shifts, deaths, wars, or just about anything else. One consent decree I can think of in, governing a state environmental agency has been in place since 1991. Yes, 1991, that's 30 years. By my count, we have had 6 presidents, 10 Senate-confirmed U.S. Attorneys General, 11 Senate-confirmed EPA administrators, and hundreds of new state and federal legislators elected. We've had significant advances in scientific understanding, major shifts in the economy and population trends, and changes in the environment. And through all of that time, despite all of these changes, a lone federal district judge has been in charge of a critical issue of environmental policy and restoration. The question from a first principles perspective is this: do the people, through their elective representatives, get a chance to reconsider critical environmental policy and funding priorities after 30 years? Do our democratic norms not require that someone other than a lone federal judge gets to revisit this vitally important issue from time to time? Fifth and finally for consent, for today anyway, I think perhaps the most significant potential problem for federal consent decrees relates uniquely to those entered into with state and local governments. Such decrees are everywhere. In an important but underappreciated book published 30 years ago by the title of Democracy by Decree, law professors Ross Sandler and David Schoenbrod outlined just how pervasive these decrees were at the time. They have been, quote, applied to the full range of government programs, including, to name just a few examples, special education, mental hospitals, environmental protection, and prisons. The decrees cover not only an enormous range of programs, but also an enormous range of states and cities. Decrees have ruled prisons in 41 states and local jails in 50 states. And this was in 2003, long before the Obama administration imposed many, many more consent decrees on state and local governments. Now, you might wonder why local officials would enter such decrees, which often diminish their powers and divert limited local financial resources. Sandler and Schoenbrod explain why in their excellent book. State and local officials, wishing to avoid embarrassment for faults in a government program, are glad to consent to a detailed plan. In other words, it is often just politically expedient. It is also a way to cement one official's preferred policy long after the official is gone. Indeed, it is a way to make it criminal for a future official to deviate from past policy choices. And finally, local officials may agree to a consent decree because it is a way to force the elected appropriators, their managers, their overseers, the legislature, to fund programs that would otherwise lose out in the necessary compromises of assembling an entire state or city budget. Federal consent decrees thus raise both vertical and horizontal separation of powers concerns. From a federalism perspective, they constitute a federal takeover of local government. From a horizontal perspective, these decrees represent the executive, rather than Congress, making policy that governs state and local governments. And at the local level, they represent local executive officials agreeing to a governing framework that the legislature, state legislature, or city council has not enacted into law. So I'll close with this. All of these concerns are what animated the Department of Justice when it was led by then Attorney General Sessions to put in place a policy establishing some guardrails around the use of consent decrees. We aimed, in the words of Madison, to oblige the Department of Justice to control itself. The memo did not prohibit consent decrees, but it meant to cabin them and put serious process around it. So the memo required that DOJ afford entities an adequate opportunity to respond to any allegations of wrongdoing. It required special caution before using a consent decree to resolve disputes with state or local government agencies. It provided guidance on the limited circumstances in which a consent decree might be appropriate, such as repeated violations that other enforcement mechanisms are not able to address. It required consent decrees usually have limited terms and clear objectives for exiting out of and terminating the consent decree, something that is often missing in most of the modern day consent decrees. It required, critically, rotation of monitors, mandatory rotation of monitors, to get rid of the financial incentives to keep the decree going for non-legal reasons. And it stated importantly, perhaps most importantly, that the consent decree must not be used to achieve general policy goals or to extract greater or different relief from the defendant than could be attained through agency enforcement authority or by litigating the matter to judgment. In other words, a consent decree had to be about law, not about the policy preferences of DOJ lawyers or enforcement agencies. And it required high-level approval by the Associate Attorney General or the Deputy Attorney General for final entry of a consent decree so that somebody with high-level responsibility was signing off on the federal takeover of a local state government agency. To my mind, our work on consent decree reform was one of the most important projects we tackled in the Sessions DOJ. Delegation, regulation, guidance, and deference got all the attention from administrative law scholars, but consent decrees are just as pervasive and probably more powerful, and the work to rein them in had never really before been done. Alas, as you heard, with a stroke of Attorney General Garland's pen, all that work has now been undone, and without, in my respectful view, any real explanation as to why. For example, his rescission memo recognizes that monitors can have conflicts of interest, a position DOJ has long held in other areas. But instead of leaving the carefully crafted policy in place, he establishes a 120-day review period for further study and recommendations from the Associate Attorney General. As far as I know, it's been well more than 120 days, and we have not seen any public disclosure of those recommendations. So we are back to the Wild West of consent decrees, and we will see where they go. And with that, I'll now turn it over to Ben, who will surely rebut everything I just said. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jesse, and thank you, Judge Branch. And happy Veterans Day to everybody, as the son and nephew and son-in-law of people who fought bravely in World War II and the Korean War. I always spend some time on this day reflecting on our gratitude and our freedom. And Jesse's right, I will disagree with a few things he says. I've represented ACLU clients in class actions against public officials for more than 35 years. My clients in most of these cases were people in the custody of the government or government-funded entities, such as prisoners, foster homes, prisons, foster homes, nursing homes, and facilities for children. These kinds of cases are often called institutional reform litigation, and many of them involved consent decrees. And I do want to insert one note of caution. I no longer work for the ACLU, so whatever I say today are the views of me and nobody else, although they reflect my 36 years working for the ACLU. The problem my cases confronted were profound, the problems. Foster care systems that brought children into the state's custody in the name of protecting them were sent to foster homes and institutions that neglected their basic needs and sometimes abused them. A large juvenile detention center housed young people in filthy conditions, repeatedly denying them essential health and educational services and exposing them to abuse by staff, a lot of it. Prisons that denied decent health care to inmates, causing unnecessary pain, sickness, and death. Hard problems causing a lot of human suffering. Elected appointed officials for years had completely failed to address these broken public systems, often misleading the public, I would say usually misleading the public about the suffering of my clients. These were, in my view, classic examples of entrenched, unlawful practices that required federal court intervention. I'll just summarize the results in a few of these cases to give you the sense of how consent decrees can make a real difference. These consent decrees often help to bring about measurable improvements in the broken government systems. Two quick examples. The changes in the foster care system in one case where I was lead counsel were described by the Congressional Quarterly Researcher as the gold standard of reform, resulting, among other things, in tens of thousands of children placed in safe, stable, adoptive homes or guardianships, improvements in the safety of children by every measure, and a reduction of the number of children lingering in temporary foster care from over 50,000 to about 16,000, consistent with safety. The litigation I mentioned involving the juvenile detention center that was so filthy and overcrowded and violent was described by one expert in a book published a couple of years ago as the most effective and best documented transformation of egregious conditions of confinement at any juvenile corrections facility in the country. I'd be happy to provide relevant sites and even sites to books and studies for anyone who's interested. In my experience, consent decrees and other structural injunctions can be very effective at imposing a structure for accountability and reform of profoundly broken government systems serving prisoners, foster children, and others with little political power. They can force public officials to acknowledge the depth of the problem, produce accurate, independent data about whether the reforms are working, sometimes they don't, and require stakeholders to go back to the drawing board when their favored prescriptions don't work. Critics often question how long these cases can last. Jesse mentioned some cases that lasted a long time. And I would say that's a fair point. The two cases I've described involving foster care and juvenile detention both lasted well over a decade, and one of them is still pending. It's certainly true that consent decrees don't magically transform hard problems into easy ones. Large broken government systems can take many years to fix, even under the pressure of a court injunction, whether a consent decree or the result of an adversarial trial. Changing the organizational culture of a large, chaotic bureaucracy and creating, sometimes almost from scratch, the infrastructure required to measure what's happening, to change incentives, to impose some accountability on unionized civil service systems, takes time. The case involving the police in Chicago that Jesse mentioned is one I didn't work on directly, but I did supervise some of the people in my office who were involved in that case. And I think it's fair to say we're still in the early stages. The consent decree probably is longer than one I would have negotiated. Very often the defendants want that. The police departments and other defendants often prefer prescriptive, detailed consent decrees to consent decrees the kind that I prefer, more focused on broad outcomes and expressing some flexibility about how you get there. I suspect we'll get to more creative strategies achieving better outcomes, and I'm confident over time that the consent decree enforced by the Attorney General and by some private parties, including some represented by the ACLU, will produce real changes, but it's going to take a while. The process is still in its infancy right now. And whether the current monitoring structure or some other such structure of oversight is the best one, I'm open to talking about that. I don't know the answer to that, and I think neither do the people who work on that case. But the thing to remember throughout that case is the problems are hard, and big, broken police systems in major cities are complex, and particularly in this era now, for the first time in a while, of slightly rising violent crime rates in a lot of cities. There are a lot of challenges about how to do that right. The process of consent decrees can also be slowed down by legitimate concerns about state and local autonomy and federalism. I think we live in a very different world than the one described in the book 30 years ago that Jesse described. The law about modifying decrees, about deferring to the judgment of new public officials is quite clear now and does create more deference to the opportunities of new state and local officials to propose changes. But the consequence of that is that the process gets dragged out. And if you impose less intrusive remedies and you have a learning curve for the new public officials who maybe haven't learned what the people in the process have learned for a few years going through things that worked and things that didn't, you end up prolonging the remedial process. And I think there are legitimate reasons for that, but the remedial process also then will prolong the human suffering that it's trying to address, at least in the kinds of cases I worked on. I would submit that the alternative to court oversight is to consign huge numbers of people to needless suffering when elected officials fail to address the problems that afflict these systems. Protecting the constitutional and statutory rights of powerless citizens through court injunctions, whether after a trial or via consent decree, in the end, I think, makes our federal system stronger. We can't consign our fellow citizens with little political power to endless abuse and neglect when the elected branches won't act. Consent decrees can be, often are, slow and messy, as Jesse pointed out, but the alternatives usually are worse. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Judge. It's an honor to be on this panel, and it's a pleasure to be asked to come back to the Federalist Society Convention, especially in person. As you can imagine, most of the things I get asked to participate in these days are more journalist than lawyerly related. And in my legal career, the worst thing I've had to worry about in the legal system is jihadist mass murder. So to me, it's much preferable than what I usually do day to day. On the theory of trying to stick with what you know, I'm going to talk about consent decrees and crime. There were, in New York City in 1990, 2,600 homicides, about seven a day. In 2017, that number had plummeted by almost 90%, down to 290. Crime was at record highs from the 70s to the 90s, and it was driven down to record lows by state policing innovations. Things like broken windows philosophy, the idea that you project the notion that the rule of law obtains and that the laws are going to be enforced. It can bring about cultural change. The idea of improving policing by being able to interview suspects and learning and making a more robust police database. That led to innovations like CompStat, the idea of not having just static police assignments, but actually deploying the police to the places where crime was beginning to surge so that you could tamp down on it before it became a problem. All of these innovations were not driven by the Justice Department or the federal government. They were driven by experimentation at the state and municipal level. The drastic improvement for civil rights cannot be overstated. African Americans suffer from disproportionately, in terms of their percentage of the population, from murder and violent crime. A near 90% drop in murder saved tens of thousands of lives. The plummeting of other violent crimes saved hundreds of thousands of criminal incidents where people were victimized. It allowed neighborhoods to thrive in safety. It allowed them to thrive economically and culturally. The record plummeting of crime in the generation beginning in the 1990s is simply the most significant social evolution in modern American history. I'm almost tempted to call it social justice. It's critical to recognize that this was not just a revolution in crime reduction, it was a revolution in policing. And it was also driven by state and local policy, not by the federal government. And that's because a system of democratic federalism, in such a system, local government must be responsive to citizens whose lives are affected, particularly affected by their policing. Because of the developments that we saw in this record reduction of crime, modern American police departments, and this is the point of it being a revolution in policing as well as crime reduction, modern American police departments are more reflective of the communities that they protect and serve than they have ever been in American history. And that's not just at the rank and file level. In cities like Atlanta, for example, where the population is 50% African American and the police department is 55% African American, there's also been an evolution in the command level so that in modern police departments, you have commanders, commissioners, deputy commissioners, all reflective, again, of the communities that they protect and serve. Society is making great progress through federalism and through democratic accountability. It does not need the Justice Department and its consent decrees to thrive and to safeguard civil rights. The Justice Department's return to its Obama-era proliferation of civil rights investigations and heavy-handed consent decrees is about advancing a racially divisive, progressive political agenda, not advancing civil rights, and not advancing quality of life. Don't take my word for it. In her August 13th memorandum revamping consent decrees, Associate Attorney General Vinita Gupta proclaimed the Justice Department's vision that consent decrees and the monitorships they impose, and this is a quote, promote transformational change in the state and local governmental entities where they are used. I'd respectfully counter that the American people and their local communities do not want transformational change. They want record low crime. They want safe streets. They want prosperous communities. They want a political class and legal elites who worry more about neighborhoods that are victimized by crime than about criminals and political narratives about systemic racism. That is the foundational canard behind the crusade to remake policing through federal consent decrees. And we must know that that political narrative is specious. The criminal justice system is dominated by graduates of elite American law schools, who overwhelmingly identify as political progressives. No small thanks to the Federalist Society, constitutional conservatives who care deeply about civil rights and equal protection under the law are also well represented. The notion that this profession would abide a system that is racist to its core should insult every one of our intelligence. Yet, that is the premise for the push for transformational change. And the political nature of this crusade is blatant. It falls into a familiar pattern. Some tragic loss of life occurs in a racially charged incident involving police and a suspect. It is often not apparent that any civil rights violation occurred. We are expected to infer one from nothing more than the race of the suspect, even if, as is often the case, the police are the same race as the suspect. It quickly becomes clear that there is no constitutional violation, but the Justice Department slipstreams in behind the heated political rhetoric and the controversy and announces a pattern or practice investigation, suggesting that there are structural departures from constitutional norms, even if they're not able to prove by prosecution a particular constitutional violation of law. States and municipalities cannot afford to go toe-to-toe with the Justice Department's bottomless budget. Plus, there are often collusive negotiations between DOJ progressives and progressive politicians who calculate that a consent decree will require so-called reforms that they wouldn't dare try to campaign on if they had to sell them at the ballot box. One way or another, the states cave. A great example is the George Floyd case in Minnesota, the trial of Derek Chauvin. Minnesota has a very progressive police department. It's led by an African-American commissioner with a reform background. They have extensive training in use of force, in conflict de-escalation. We heard endlessly at the trial that it's drummed into the police that this idea of in my custody, in my care. If you have a suspect in your custody, you are responsible for the suspect's well-being, drummed into every officer by hours and hours of training. Every police official who testified at the trial of Derek Chauvin said that the tactics that were used on the street by the police officer violated basic tenets of Minnesota police training, even against suspects who were resisting arrest. And obviously, Minnesota prosecuted the rogue cop, and the jury believed the police witnesses who said that the behavior on the streets ran afoul of what their training was in the Minnesota Police Department. Yet, the Department of Justice could not wait to announce that it was opening a pattern and practice investigation, as if those of us who watched a month of the trial had witnessed rampant constitutional violations day after day. The response of the Justice Department is a response to situational politics, not a response to courtroom evidence. In our system, the states are sovereign and should be trusted to govern their own internal affairs. Policing is the most central and consequential of those affairs. If state and local enforcement officials really do violate federal law and the Constitution, it is always available to the Justice Department to prosecute civil rights cases by criminal indictment. But the idea that the federal government, that it's the federal government's job to transform the nation's police departments should be offensive. The idea that the feds always know best what to do should be offensive. It was not the Justice Department and consent decrees and monitors that gave us those record low crime rates. It was state and local police, and it was a historic boon for civil rights. Thank you.
Thank you, Andy. Robert.
I like going last because it gives me a chance to respond to things that have been said before. As Judge Branch indicated, way back in 1987, I wrote an article on consent decrees in the same symposium issue on consent decree of the University of Chicago Legal Forum that Mike McConnell published his article, Why Hold Elections, arguing that consent decrees fundamentally undermine democracy. In that article, I said that the longstanding public policy favoring settlements and that consent decrees simply made those more enforceable. They're not a form of legislation, as Jesse said. They're a means of enforcing existing law. I noted in that article that the Meese memo, which was actually kept in place by the Justice Department, had made minor changes that made it so that they weren't doing things that infringed on democratic principles. Now, Jesse indicated that when Merrick Garland in April withdrew the session's guidance on consent decree, he promised that there would be a 120-day review and that he had heard nothing since then. Well, let me tell you what they did do. In fact, exactly 120 days later, on August 13th, 2021, the Associate Attorney General issued the report that Attorney General Garland had asked for. And in preparing this report, they conducted more than 50 listening sessions with stakeholders, including current and former monitors, state and local officials, police chiefs and national law enforcement organizations, civil rights advocates, community leaders, and academics. These listening sessions, I'm quoting from the memo, revealed a remarkably consistent story. Most felt strongly the consent decrees had acted as the primary catalyst in transforming the state and local agencies in which they were used. Many recognized that consent decrees provide state and local governments with a stable long-term plan to reform agencies and departments, and in the law enforcement context, to rebuild trust between law enforcement agencies and the communities they serve. They looked at a number of studies of police consent decrees that showed that they had not only reduced the incidence of illegal activities by the police, but also improved community relations. The memo stressed that the Justice Department wanted to learn and evolve from past practice, and it recommended some very specific changes that I think respond directly to the criticisms Jesse was making. Here are the principles for dealing with monitorships of state and local government entities. First, monitorships should be designed to minimize the cost to jurisdictions and to avoid any appearance of conflict of interest. How? Cap monitors' fees. Decrees should include an annual cap on monitors' fees. Second, encourage use of pro bono time, reduced rates in nonprofit organizations and academic institutions. Third, explore alternative fee arrangements. Fourth, restrict lead monitor participation in multiple monitorships. Second principle, monitors must be accountable to the court, the parties, and the public. How do you do that? First, collect public input during monitor selection. Second, impose term limits subject to judicial reevaluation and reappointment. After the first 2 or 3 years, consent decrees should build in a procedure for assessing the monitor before any reappointment can occur. Fourth, make monitoring documents publicly accessible. Another principle, monitors should assess compliance consistently across jurisdiction. A fourth principle, sustained meaningful engagement with the community is critical to the success of a monitorship. You should first select monitors who will prioritize stakeholder input. Second, require consistent local feedback. Third, modernize monitor communication strategies by encouraging, among other things, the use of social media so the community can follow what the monitor is doing. Final principle, monitoring must be structured to efficiently move jurisdictions into compliance. Monitorships must be designed to incentivize the monitor and the jurisdiction to move towards compliance as efficiently as possible. How do you do that? Require a hearing to assess termination after no more than 5 years. Jesse talked about how some of these decrees have been in existence for many, many years. Unfortunately, that's because some of the problems, like environmental cleanups and the mess EPA had with the initial implementation of the Clean Water Act that generated the Flannery decree, that ultimately was actually embodied into legislation when Congress amended the Clean Air Act, they're really difficult to deal with and it takes a lot of time. Encourage use of partial termination provisions. Prioritize project management skills in monitor selection. So the conclusion of this memo was monitorships have proven to be vital tools in upholding the rule of law and promoting transformational change in the state and local government entities where they are used. Andrew may not like the word transformational, but some of the police abuses in these departments are so great. In Baltimore, where I teach, the cops, some of the cops, were actually totally corrupt, arresting people so they could rob them. And it was only when the federal government came in and indicted them and ended up several of the cops went to prison that the rot that was in that police department started to be cleaned up. And a consent decree, it's not perfect, it hasn't completely solved all the problems, but it has at least provided hope for improvement. Exactly a month later, on September 13th, 2021, the Attorney General Merrick Garland said in a memo, "The Associate Attorney General has now provided, and I approve, a set of principles for the use of monitors in civil settlement agreements and consent decrees involving state and local governmental entities." So the Biden administration is trying to learn from history, responding to some of the criticisms that have been made about what's happened in the past, and is working to ensure that we develop a more efficient system of enforcing the law, enforcing constitutional norms, and particularly increasing community confidence in the agencies of state and local government that they deal with. Thank you.
I know Robert said he loves going last because he gets to respond to everybody, and not to take that position away from him, but I would like to open it up to the panel. If there's anybody that would like to respond to another panelist, please feel free to do so. And I know Jesse has something to say.
Yeah, so I'll respond to that. So I did realize, actually, before it got to you, I'll note that that I had missed Associate Attorney General Gupta's memo. In fairness, I see the date that it was made public. I was on my honeymoon in Hawaii with my lovely wife who's here. So I think I'll be excused for missing it. But I do have some responses to that. So one, you know, you have to look carefully at what's said there. I would be curious to know who the interested stakeholders were that DOJ invited, because I guarantee you I could find some that who would not have been overwhelmingly effusive about the process of consent decrees in their agencies. I worked with many of those state officials as a state official for many years. But if you look carefully at what the memo says, it doesn't actually include any term limits. It says, well, there should be a process for thinking about maybe having the judge impose a term limit if the judge finds the monitor's not doing a good job. Well, guess what? That's what judges are supposed to be doing right now. That's what they're supposed to have been doing for the last 40 years of monitorships. But in practice, it never happens. It never happens because these consent decrees are overwhelmingly long and judges don't want to deal with them, so they hand it off to the monitor. The other main issue is it doesn't deal with the root cause problem of monitors, which is who the heck is a monitor to exercise essentially government power. They haven't been elected by anyone in the local community. They haven't been appointed by any responsible government official in the local community. And so the Sessions memo said this: just as it would be extraordinary for a federal agency to consent to the use of a monitor to oversee its operations or policies, in most cases, there is little reason to expect or require a state or local government, equally a democratically accountable entity, to do so. And so the Sessions memo said, look, if you DOJ lawyers can't oversee this consent decree yourself, then maybe you shouldn't be having this consent decree. And that principle is gone and not in the new principles announced in the Gupta memo.
So, Judge, if I'd like to respond to that just briefly. I've had mixed experience with monitors. In one case, the judge fired a monitor, and actually the parties under the supervision of the judge negotiated a structure where we created the Children and Family Research Center at the University of Illinois and funded it to produce data on child welfare outcomes and how our clients were doing. We learned enormously from them over several years, and they were extremely helpful, and their work still goes on, even though most of it isn't anymore about the consent decree and those issues. In other cases, monitors have been terrific in my cases. The key is you need a way not to just have lawyers in the room making decisions about how to fix a government system. So if monitors can bring in law enforcement expertise, if they can bring in medical expertise in the case of issues involving healthcare in prisons and in foster care systems, if they can bring in expertise in organizational change, which is something lawyers think they know about, and they think if they change a rule, everybody's going to do better, you know, pass a rule saying all the caseworkers in the foster care system should do a better job. Oh, that's great. That'll make a big difference. You know, the real problem is much subtler and more complex, and you have to try different things and measure the outcomes. And when it's done right, bringing expertise and measuring outcomes, but not creating a command system where the monitor's word is law, which is not typical in my experience, it can be very important and well worth the investment. Sometimes it's not. I want to respond to one thing about crime rates, too, that Andrew said. Crime rates plummeted all over the country in the 90s, late 80s, 90s, and early 2000s. Some of those places had broken windows policing. A lot of those places didn't. You know, correlation is not cause, and it's very important to think analytically about these issues and what really produces change. I looked somewhat closely at that in the Chicago police context, and I'll just tell you, it's hard. You know, there's literature that suggests that changes in the amount of lead in pipes, reproductive choice for women who don't want to have a pregnancy, real estate values. You know, San Francisco had a huge drop in crime rates because people couldn't afford to live there if they were poor, and that happened in New York too to some degree. It's important to look at these issues in a nuanced way, and particularly now with all the attention to crime rates happening again, because we're nowhere near where we were in the 60s and 70s, but there has been an increase. It's really important in the context of judicial relief and consent decrees and all of these issues, not to accept simple answers that look to correlation and not more subtly at cause. Thanks.
Andy?
Yeah, I just respond to that I'm all for nuance. I think the best way to do nuance is not to have a one-size-fits-all solution that's imposed by a Justice Department model. Doesn't surprise me in the slightest that the decline in crime, generational decline in crime, featured different approaches to crime, and that there were some things like CompStat which caught on, especially in the places that were able to do it, but there were other municipalities that were able to experiment with other solutions and also saw success. I think that's exactly what we want. We want solutions to these problems driven by the people who are making the decisions close to home, who answer politically to the people whose lives are at stake and whose lives are affected by the policing. So I'm all for nuance. Let's have as much nuance as we can. If you have 50 different laboratories of democracy, you're going to have a lot more nuance than you're going to get out of the Department of Justice.
And now, Robert, I will give you the last word.
Okay.
Yet again.
Yeah, I would like to congratulate Jesse on his marriage, and he picked a great place to honeymoon. The point I'd make is that I think the approach the Biden administration is taking is that you have to tailor what is done in consent decrees and what level of authority approves them to the individual facts and circumstances. You can't just have a broad brush policy that says, we don't like consent decrees, so if we have any, it's got to be approved by the Attorney General or the top officials at the Justice Department. Some decrees are much different than others. And in fact, in virtually every environmental enforcement action against a corporation, it's settled by consent decrees. Some of those are enormously complex, like the consent decree that settled the BP Horizon oil spill, or the consent decree that settled the criminal litigation against the Volkswagen company for intentionally violating our environmental laws by cheating on the testing. And so even during the Trump administration, you had consent decrees in environmental enforcement cases. Because they've proven to be a very effective tool for enforcement. And when you're dealing with an entity like a corporation, you can't just rely on the promise that changes are going to be made and this isn't going to happen again. In similar fashion, some state and local government entities needed substantial change. And I think the approach of the Biden administration is a good one, and the fact that they've signaled that they're responding very specifically to some of the criticisms that Jesse and others have made of consent decrees indicates that they're on the right track, and certainly their emphasis on trying to get better community support for the police. I would just say that the fundamental point I made in that 1987 Law Review article that consent decrees don't undermine democracy. Mike McConnell said, why hold elections? I would suggest that today there are far more fundamental threats to democracy, and I don't see a lot of panels at this conference that are addressing those. I wish there were.
Thank you. I've got just a couple of questions before I'm going to open it up to the audience in about 10, 12 minutes, just to let you know. But I've got a couple of questions I'm going to exercise my privilege as moderator to ask. Let me start with Andy. Andy, you started by talking about the policing techniques of the 90s, and then you had pivoted to the Department of Justice's concern about police departments, the pattern or practice of unconstitutional policing. Could the policing techniques of the 90s exist today?
I don't believe with the assumptions that are informing transformational change, I do not believe that the techniques that began to be developed under the broken windows ideas of the 1990s would be possible today. And in part, I think this is in largest part, the models that the remedies that were used in the 1990s really were driven by data. And I think they were driven unapologetically by data. And what I fear is that today they are driven not by data but by a political narrative. And to the extent that reality crashes into the political narrative wins. And as a result, I think the things that we know would work would have a very hard time being used. Let me just take one concrete example. Stop and frisk, which has gotten a lot of attention and a lot of negative attention, and some of it is merited because there are obviously some episodes involved in that where people's rights were in fact violated. But there's a lot of people who analyze that from a standpoint of, if you stop and frisk X percentage of people who are a particular race, and it turns out that that is overrepresentative population-wise of other groups that get stopped and frisked, then there's implicitly a problem. When in point of fact, the most important thing in crime is offense pattern and offense behavior, not a person's particular race. And if it happens that there are neighborhoods or even racial groups where offense patterns are higher than others, that is simply a fact of why the crime takes place. And I don't think that that's something that you could recognize in the 1990s. I don't think that you'd be allowed to recognize it today.
May I briefly respond to that?
Yes.
There certainly is high crime in some black neighborhoods, but the enforcement of the law has a huge racial component in a lot of big cities that is not just because of crime. I'll give you one example in Illinois. I could give you 30. Marijuana until recently was illegal to possess and to use, and many of me and my friends nevertheless broke those laws in high school and college. And that's one reason I was passionate about representing kids in the juvenile detention center. Black kids were arrested for marijuana possession at 7 or more times the rate of white kids in Illinois. And everybody who studies the question agrees that the usage rates were not higher. In fact, because white kids have, on the average, more money, it's quite likely that they used a bit more. Same thing with stop and frisk. I mean, treating black people as second-class citizens isn't good law enforcement. We have a consent decree, a settlement agreement, actually, involving stop and frisk practices in Chicago. When we look closely at it, I mean, people were just being stopped for no good reason. It wasn't that there was a principled offense pattern. There was nothing except, prejudice and sloppiness on the part of many of the Chicago police. Not all. There were good stops, but many. So let's not ignore the racial aspect of the problem, too. It's not the only problem. Sometimes my compatriots and allies may overstate it as the answer to everything, and I recognize there are more things involved. But treating a category of people as second-class citizens isn't good policing.
Jesse, I have a question for you. When you were at the Department of Justice, and the consent decree process did exist, but perhaps on a much more limited basis, but how are cases selected at the Department of Justice? Who approves that selection? How does that work?
Thanks for that question. I think the answer is who knows. things are reported, things come to light, but there is a cadre of lawyers at DOJ whose job it is to go out and find these cases. And so they will, I think as Andy said, sort of follow a political controversy into a community and say, okay, we've got to put out a report to show we're doing something, and then we've got to go in and have a wide-ranging consent decree and cut off any local solutions. So, when I was there, I think I heard that they'll get reports from the public, or they'll find things on social media, et cetera. And that's not, I'm not sure that's how local government should be taken over or processed in this country. I think there are deep issues, and we don't see any process around that. There is no DOJ policy or standard for which cases merit a consent decree and which don't. And that gets to a fundamental problem, and I think it responds to some of what Ben was saying, which is, look, there are real tough societal problems out there. Children in the foster care system, prisoners, racial justice and policing. It turns out that in society everywhere since the beginning of time, everybody's got problems, and they all think they're serious, and there's only limited resources of the government to spend on those problems, and some people win and some people lose. It's a zero-sum game. Now, we in America and our framers came up with something ingenious so that we could all have a say in how that problem gets resolved. It's called legislatures, elected by the people. And you go to the legislature and you plead your case, and sometimes you win and sometimes you lose, and most often you get half a loaf. and everybody feels a little pain, and we disperse it throughout the society. But what happens in these consent decree cases is one group that gets represented by a powerful public interest firm, like, say, the ACLU or some other, gets a stranglehold on those resources and gets to say, we get 100% of the resources that we need to solve our problem. And if anybody else isn't politically powerful enough to get one of those groups behind them, too bad, so sad, go to the legislature and see what you can get. But you're not getting a federal court to demand the resources for you. And to me, that is just undemocratic, and it goes against the fundamental way we solve problems in American democratic society.
Robert, I mentioned, and you also mentioned, your 1987 article about federal consent decrees. How have your views changed over time, and do you have any concerns now that you didn't have then?
Well, I know a lot more about consent decrees than I did then. I think it was actually the first academic article I ever wrote. I was just in the process of joining the University of Maryland to start their environmental law program, and one thing that sort of stung me was I was sort of personally attacked by Mike McConnell, who suggested that I had been involved in the Flannery decree that he was attacking in his article and just trying to feather my own nest. I had no involvement at all. My group had signed on as one of the many groups that supported the litigation, but did not. It was NRDC who brought that, and I was working for the Environmental Defense Fund. There's been sort of a steady evolution that the concern back then was undermining democracy, and I think that's almost laughable compared to the current concerns about very real things that are undermining democracy. Then back in 2012, I testified before a House committee on sue and settle. The concern there was that the Obama administration would enter into collusive settlements with environmentalists in order to do things that they wouldn't otherwise have been able to do under the statute. And I pointed out all the safeguards against that, and it just didn't happen. Yet this morning's Wall Street Journal has an op-ed from Peter Wallison saying maybe sue and settle is coming back because of the controversy over whether or not the Justice Department will agree to damages awards to parents who were separated from their children. I would say the most important piece of evidence that sue and settle is not back in the environmental context is the Giuliana litigation, where a group of children, actually at the end of the Obama administration, sued the Justice Department with a very novel complaint. They said, our substantive due process rights have been denied because the federal government's done nothing about climate change while promoting use of fossil fuels, and that we have a constitutional right now and in the future to have an environment free of the dangers of climate change. The Justice Department and the Obama administration fought that tooth and nail, as did the Trump administration. Now that their lawsuit was rejected by a panel of the Ninth Circuit on standing grounds, on the redressability prong of standing, the plaintiffs have filed a motion to amend their complaint to say they no longer want the court to direct reductions in greenhouse gas emissions. They just want a declaration that we have this substantive due process right. And they were ordered to enter into settlement negotiations with the Biden administration. The Biden administration refused to settle with them, and just this week, the plaintiffs issued a press release saying the negotiations have broken down. So I think, you know, that it's almost like, you know, the war on Christmas coming back, that people get all exercised about these things, and it later proves just simply not to be true.
Robert, I think Jesse again has something to
say. I'll just respond on that. It's not a panel necessarily on sue and settle, although consent decrees are essentially sue and settle, often for the other side. I mentioned those political incentives at the local level. But I'll just say this, because I can't resist, to use the Giuliana litigation as an example of sue and settle not coming back. The underlying legal theory is so patently absurd that no lawyer could bring themselves to say I would settle a case like that. I think I think, you know, the fact that the children of the world have a substantive due process right to have a federal judge oversee emissions is probably a step too far, even for the Obama or Biden Justice Departments. But I promise you, Sue and Settle is on its way back, because all of the other memos we put in place to stop that have also been withdrawn, which is a panel for another day.
All right, we're going to turn this over to audience questions, and I can already see my friend Mike is on his way up there. Just as a quick reminder, if you're addressing it to a specific panel member, please let us know if you would say your name, and if you could ask the question and not do the speaking question, that would be helpful too.
Michael Bushbacher from Boyne Gray & Associates. My question, I think, is primarily for Professor Percival. You mentioned that consent decrees are about enforcing the law, but going back to 1986, the Supreme Court said in the firefighters case that, in fact, consent decrees can have things that not only are beyond what the law would allow if you litigated to judgment, but can even go against what you could get there. And so what I'm curious about is, with that level of flexibility, and that's how it works out in the environmental context, for instance, with supplemental environmental projects, which everyone agrees are things you cannot get if you litigate to judgment. With that flexibility built into the law, it seems to undermine that point. And I'm curious for your thoughts on what limits exist and why they exist, and whether the Supreme Court is right in the firefighter's case and why.
Okay, well, with respect to supplemental environmental projects, when I was first asked to be on this panel, the first thing I said is it in person? And I was so pleased they said yes. The last time I was on such a panel, well, I was speaking in Adelaide, Australia in March 2020 at a conference of the International Network of Environmental Compliance and Enforcement. And it was just as the Jeff Clark memo on supplemental environmental projects was about to be issued. And the various experts on environmental enforcement from all over the world were like puzzled, why is the U.S. wanting to eliminate supplemental environmental projects? In Australia, they're called EUs, for environmental undertakings, because they essentially are designed to mitigate the harm that's been done by an environmental violation by doing something that's going to help correct the harm that had been caused by the violation. So I thought Clark was kind of out there as, well, I won't talk about his subsequent activities, but in that memo, and that it's a good thing that they are being restored. Now, it's the, as you say, the courts have held that you don't necessarily, that details that are in the consent decrees could go beyond what you might be able to get in litigation. I submit that consent decrees, we've evolved a lot from the initial effort to desegregate the schools that confronted judges in, you know, almost a weekly basis with what is this agency supposed to do? Do we have busing? Do we have all these other measures to try to desegregate the schools? Now consent decrees are a tool that can help judges in enforcing things such as remedying constitutional and statutory violations. And I believe the department has been pretty careful in both Democratic and Republican administrations in not trying to use consent decrees as a vehicle to feather their own nest, but trying to tailor them to how do we remedy specific violations, and that may require things that you wouldn't necessarily get if you just left it to the judge to make all these decrees.
All right, my friend Mike is up next.
Okay, and so as a friendship request, I will personally just ask a question. all right, so could you each of you talk a little bit about backdoor examples of packing consent decrees, because it cuts both ways. My experience with the FTC, I'm not a lawyer, I negotiate consent decrees with them, I just walked away because they wanted like a gag order and cookie cutter, 20 years, everyone was 20 years, there was no negotiation, it was take it or leave it. What have you seen that you've tried to backdoor in this outrage, or seen that's been tried to backdoor in, to defend the defendant, or to help the government's position? Because I don't think they're really cookie cutter.
Maybe I don't quite understand. You're asking whether the defendants in these cases sometimes get provisions that they want into the decrees?
Well, my personal opinion is that's kind of rare, but yeah. I was trying to be fair. my opinion is that it gets jammed down our throat, and it's a gun to your head to take or leave it because it's cheaper to leave, but I'm trying to be more objective.
Well, I think it depends what you're talking. If you're talking about a consent decree with a private party, you know, as with any federal prosecution, the choice for a defendant is often this or something worse if we go to trial. Now, I will say for consent decrees, the worse is usually going to be, major fines or prison time, not necessarily, because the DOJ, my view is, could not get most of these structural things that they want in litigation to judgment because the law doesn't authorize it, and that's the big problem. Now, with state and local governments, it actually does work both ways. It might have been Ben or Bob who said this, but you know, a lot of times these governments want very prescriptive things now in there. But I mentioned this in my comments, one of the reasons the locals enter these decrees is the controversy is political, and once they say, we have a decree, problem solved, they can just say, it's off my plate, and you know, now I'm running for my next thing, and that won't hurt my election anymore. So you do get defendants assenting to these, you know, probably when they shouldn't, and it's a huge problem. I mean, as a former state official who came in and had to deal with legacy decrees, you're basically handcuffed. I mean, I remember quite clearly when I went to work for the governor of the third largest state in the country, and we had all these ideas, and I had to, you know, on the environment or this or that, and I said, sorry, we can't do that because 35 years ago, one of your predecessors, who's no longer alive, entered a consent decree. What is that? You know, it just doesn't make any sense in terms of government.
I don't know much about the FTC problem that you alluded to. I apologize. But I there's something I want to say broadly responding to the first two questions. The right... and the problem of violating a foster kid's right to minimally adequate care and not to be in dangerous conditions or prisoners' right to health care doesn't tell you how to fix it. And some of the conservative literature makes this point effectively, I think, and you know, I agree with it. So very often remedies have to reach into things that are not necessarily the direct application of the right. I mean, if all you did was remedy the right, you just have a declaration saying they're violating somebody's rights, figure out how to fix it and submit a plan. And there are some decrees that are more like that, and I actually don't think that's so bad. The defendant gets the first opportunity to try to fix it. They usually fail, and then you work with experts and try to figure out how to fix it more subtly. Those things inevitably involve something a judge, after a trial, wouldn't order in the first place, but the process would emerge that way. For the critics of consent decrees, I would ask... I think the Prison Litigation Reform Act pretty much gave you everything you want in terms of restrictions on the scope and duration of consent decrees and judgments in prison litigation, and I do prison litigation along with other things. And the statute has had a significant effect on pro se prison filings, and we can debate the merits of that. I think they lost some good ones, but they also lost a lot of frivolous ones, I admit. I don't think it's had as much effect on class action litigation of the kind that I do. A defendant can move to terminate the whole process after 2 years if you have a consent decree and make the plaintiff reprove liability. But the problems are hard, and in my cases at least, yeah, we can reprove liability. We have court-appointed experts or our own consulting experts, and the problem is still there. And, you know, defendants don't even file that motion because the constitutional problem and the human suffering is still there. They don't want a court to have to hear all that and the public to hear all that. So in some ways, the notion that these things last forever or that they're inappropriate restrictions on state and local discretion is disproven by the experience of the Prison Litigation Reform Act. I don't mind the Prison Litigation Reform Act most of the time, except the low attorney's fees and a few things. because I can prove liability 10 years into a case. If it's not still bad, what am I doing? So that's a total digression from what you were trying to find out about.
Wish the FTC was outside of that, but anyway.
Yeah, I would just, to go back to the Minnesota example, and this... My point is the one that Jesse's made much better, which is that you're going to have a sweeping resolution or sweeping prescription on the basis of a very finite, narrow problem. If what is the trigger for having a consent decree ultimately or some kind of a resolution in Minnesota is an incident involving use of force, where on a fairly interesting, dynamic criminal law episode, a police detention that starts out legal evolves into criminal assault because excessive force is used. And despite all of the testimony in the trial, where the one police officer, one police expert after another says, what happened out on the street as it evolved is a departure from our procedures that we train day after day after day, and log, and every single cop has a schedule that he or she has received this training day after day after day. If that's going to be the trigger for a pattern of practice investigation, and I do think we haven't talked too much about this, but I think part of the problem with the pattern of practice investigation is that when Congress put it into the law in 1994, there's no objective metrics for what triggers it. You know, they can just decide, you know, we think we need a pattern of practice investigation. If you're ultimately promulgating settlements that are 300 pages long and 799 paragraphs long, then you're not dealing with a narrow issue of excessive use of force, even assuming the proof that came out at the trial suggested that it was necessary to deal with that issue in some kind of a supervisory systemic way. So I can't speak to environmental litigation because I don't know enough about it, or the FTC, or even your prison experience. But what I see happening time after time after time with police and law enforcement is that a single incident is used pretextually to draft what turns out to be a charter of how policing is to be done. And that is just wrong.
I would just point out that, you know, consent decrees can be modified. The Flannery decree, the court modified it six different times. So if it's not working the way it's supposed to, and in order to be entered, the parties have to agree to it. So if they're willing to do things that go beyond what a court might order as a violation of law because it would make it less likely that the violation would happen in the future, they can agree to that, and that does happen.
Thanks, Mike. Yes.
Hey, a con man is still a con man, even if he doesn't rip off every one of his business associates. And a serial killer is still a serial killer, even if he lets one of his kidnapped victims go free. As a matter of logic, pointing out an exception does not defeat the rule. I'm somebody who does fear that soon settles coming back. And my worry is accentuated by the fact that Joe Biden, after saying that the reports were garbage, he then changed his mind, I guess, after being propped up, being given his drugs, and being told that Bernie's back in town. So what I'm wondering, fearing that soon settles coming back, is there an argument that's better than pointing out one solitary example? Because again, the example does not defeat the rule. And second question is, in my view, my fear is that the ACLU is joined at the hip with the DOJ. Are there ways to stop that from happening?
We aren't. I mean, we fight with DOJ all the time, irrespective of the administration. In my career, I've sued more Democrats than Republicans. I mean, Rod Blagojevich was the worst governor Illinois ever had, not just because he was a crook, although that was a factor. I think the dynamic of DOJ cases is very different than of the kind of cases we do, where we represent the actual people who are suffering, and I don't want to say too much about that. But the one instance of sue and settle that I saw in Illinois where we were looking at possible litigation was the Cook County Jail healthcare case, which, by the way, caused huge positive changes. And the reason the defendant settled right after the suit is because there had been a long DOJ investigation with expert reports that were public. And this stuff should be transparent. References to gag orders always scare me as an ACLU lawyer. And it was obvious the problem was horrible. And so when DOJ sued, they had already negotiated a consent decree. That didn't strike me as a big problem. I haven't seen the kind of collusive stuff that it sounds like you fear. I just haven't seen it in our cases. You know, we sue and have years of discovery and fights. We don't settle right away, almost ever.
Can you speak to the immigration litigation and giving each illegal alien $450,000?
Well, I think that was just a settlement. I mean, everybody acknowledged that something horrible had been done. It was just a question of what to do about it. I didn't work on it. That's a national ACLU case. But, I mean, money settlements in cases where something horrible has been done happen all the time. Was that particularly unusual? I don't think so.
May I say one thing about that? This will cut against my diatribes against settlement decrees, but I do think that you're hitting on a different and related problem, which is what do the people who are saddled with a problem do when Congress is AWOL on something Congress needs to address? So you have, in the immigration context, a literal application of federal law that says that people who come in under the circumstances that the migrants we're talking about come in shall be detained. That's what federal law says. And then there's a whole different channel of law that deals with children. And it starts to deal with unaccompanied minors, but because it's a much more complex problem, those principles end up being extended by courts because they're not getting any guidance from Congress to accompanied minors or people who present as a family unit. Now, if you literally, I think what bothers me and what bothers people who are annoyed by the exorbitant amounts that have been reported in connection with these settlement talks is it's counterintuitive to think that you can literally apply federal law and have caused tortious emotional harm to people such that they should be rewarded under circumstances where they came to the country illegally. And even though there's a harm, if somebody has to be responsible for the harm, it's the people who shouldn't have come here in the first place. But the fact of the matter is, the reason we have the problem we have is if you literally apply the law, then you are separating children from their parents. And that's a fact. That's what the federal statutes say. Now, whether people should get a payday out of that, and I don't mean to minimize, I know that there were terrible damage that was done and emotional harm that was done by virtue of what happened. I saw it myself for 20 years as a prosecutor. Every time we prosecuted somebody for a serious crime, the family was affected, and they were emotionally distraught over it. It's part of what happens in law enforcement. But I do think a big part of the problem that we're dealing with here, I don't like all the experimentation that the courts do. I don't like it when the Justice Department sees a statute that says shall be detained, and they decide that they're allowed to parole people into the country because they've let more in than they have housing for. But the fact is, if Congress doesn't step up to the plate and provide guidance in these places in the law where you need guidance from Congress, it's tough to blame the people who the problem falls in the lap of for groping for a solution, which is, I think, a lot of people in good faith are trying to grope for a solution. That doesn't mean everyone should get a $450,000 settlement. But a big part of the problem here is political paralysis more than anything else.
Let me just add one thing here without wading into the necessary controversy, but I think I can tie this question back to consent decrees.
Oh, yeah, right.
I didn't mean it that way. The issue that federal agencies were dealing with, the Obama administration, the Trump administration, and now the Biden administration, is that in the 1990s, the Clinton administration agreed to a consent decree in California called the Flores Consent Decree. Yeah. And it now controls this policy, and no federal officer has been able to figure out a way to get out from under that consent decree and have proactive policy change or implement any new policies, because every time they try to do something, they have to go to a federal judge in California, and they have to go to this plaintiff's group that sued 30 years ago and got what they wanted, And that has led, you know, in part to a very difficult policy situation. There's a lot of other things that feed into it, but at the root of that issue is a consent decree that has not gone away and will never go away. And nobody knows a way out of that box, because there's a federal judge behind it who doesn't have to answer to anyone and can say, this is what we're going to do, even if the agency officials involved want to come up with a different policy solution.
So there are very conservative principles now, post-RUFO in the 90s, about modifying consent decrees. And the defendants failed to meet that standard in their effort to modify or get rid of the Flores decree repeatedly. It turned out, when you unpacked it, they weren't saying something principled enough to persuade the judge and the Ninth Circuit. I mean, I don't know enough about it to know who's right, but I mean, there was a real discussion of it, and they lost.
All right. And I'm going to introduce the next audience member who is going to ask a question. This is my current law clerk, Seth Cohen. And I'm also pleased, as I look around the room, I see former law clerks of mine, current law clerks of mine, and future law clerks of mine.
I was wondering how we got such a full audience.
Well, after that, I'm going to hope this isn't a sophomoric question. So the Constitution permits Congress to abrogate state sovereign immunity to enforce the 14th and 15th Amendment. But as the Supreme Court has told us, even that has limits, and separate sovereignty and the equal dignity accorded to separate sovereigns does eventually weigh out when factual circumstances change. So I guess in light of Shelby Counter v. Holder, might there be a constitutional problem with these perpetual consent decrees, both the one that we're talking about in California and, for instance, the one in Chicago?
A problem based on the autonomy of states? Is that what you're at, based on the...
Yeah, and the fact that the factual circumstances in many of these cases do change over time, even if it doesn't necessarily produce the remedy that the parties to which the parties initially consented.
You want to start, Jess?
I think I'll make this not sophomore. It's a very law clerk question. It's deep in constitutional theory. Look, I think there are constitutional problems with these. Whether it's tied into that specifically is interesting to think about. I think I want to say something related that is related to something Ben said as well, which is, you have these federal rights. So let's say it was a permissible federal statute that is addressing some constitutional violation. But there's another dynamic going on, which is, and it's the same thing, like you have a political dynamic of why local officials will enter these decrees. But the statutes that get sued under are often these environmental or civil rights statutes that really don't solve a problem, because that's not really the business Congress is in. Congress is in the business of solving its political problems. So society gets loud about some issue, and they say Congress must act, so Congress passes some vague statute with standards in it that states need to meet. They don't fund the mandate, and then they say, go meet it. And then plaintiffs can go out and sue and say, you're not meeting this vague statute that was passed, and then you have to come up with the remedies in court. So there's a dynamic going on at Congress as well, and I think part of your question would be, are those vague statutes that become the basis for the underlying lawsuits themselves constitutional, and maybe the question is, well, you can't look at the statute itself. You have to look at how they're applied in practice. And if they're applied in practice with a 30-year consent decree that changes over time, maybe the 14th and 15th Amendment do have something to say about that.
Anyone else?
Yeah, I would just say it would seem to me that the way these litigations go, and as Jesse's pointing out, the way the question is teed up.
Excuse me.
Pretty standard canons of interpretation would sort of push the constitutional problems to the back, right? So if you can resolve these disputes without having to reach these, fundamental questions, that's what you do. I don't know that if you were, if we were Congress instead of a litigation process dealing with a problem, you would like to see them go right to the fundamental problems, but I think the way litigation works, it just doesn't it doesn't work that way most of the time.
Thank you. Thanks, Seth. And we have time for one more. You've been waiting at the back for the longest.
Thank you. Richard Benson in the Chicago Lawyers Chapter. Thank you for sharing your wisdom with us. I'm curious from a criminal justice perspective. We've talked about the Chicago consent decree, and then shortly thereafter, or in spring, the legislature passed a significant criminal justice reform bill, including standardized police behaviors in the statute. And then in Texas, we have the Houston consent decree, or Harris County, about cash bail abolition for misdemeanor crimes or charges. And then the Texas legislature in special session just passed a significant bail reform. So I'm curious if you see maybe perhaps a positive interplay of consent decrees forcing states to actually address some of these concerns from a legislative perspective, or if the administrative cost of compliance are actually too high to justify what's occurred in those two specific jurisdictions. Thank you.
I mean, legislatures certainly have the ability to push back. In my experience, when they talk about doing that, and I don't know the specifics of some of the things you mentioned, the state authorities who settled the case, or the local authorities, end up telling them the facts and they back off. One example. The director of the Department of Children and Family Services in Illinois, who was the defendant in our case, and there was one director in particular who was very gifted and won national awards and worked with us constructively to fix a lot of the problems and help kids get out of the system safely. Some of the people in the state Senate thought that the consent decree was getting in the way of the legislative process, much in the way that everybody talked about up here. So they proposed legislation that any new consent decree that would cost over a certain amount or involve certain kinds of restrictions on state authority would have to be approved by the legislature. The Attorney General, who was, I think, a Republican then, the director of the Department of Children and Family Services and the governor's office all opposed it and said, we don't want to come to you and have to explain how bad it is and why we're doing this. I didn't think it was a big deal. Look, if they want to have a trial, we'll have a trial. But it's the very people running state government that I think for legitimate reasons don't want to prolong the process of trying to address these problems with a consent decree.
Anyone else? All right, well, that is going to conclude our panel. I'd like to thank the panelists and the audience for joining us today. And just as a reminder that the next convention event, you'll have three panels to choose from. Those events will start at 1:45. And thank you all for being here today.
It was fun. Take care.